Welcome to Everyday Drinkers. This is a yet another special episode. This week, we're going to be talking with Henry Price. Really, we're going to be focusing on topics in mixology, cocktails, and the overall spirit industry. Henry Price is a president and CEO of Price Imports, has become exposed to many of the great mixologists in the industry. He's been in the business for 35 years, started with wine, and has moved into premium spirits. Henry is passionate about the industry and bringing the best spirits to the United States from other countries. The cocktail business is a growing trend. Younger folks are starting to really drink cocktails over other beverages like wine. Hopefully, we could shed some light on what is coming in our future with cocktails and the next movement of different types of spirits and liqueurs. There's a revolution of cocktail making in this industry. It's changing, and hopefully, by listening to shows like this, speaking with some of these guys that have been doing this for years, you'll learn something. Pay attention. Listen up. We are at the start of something really great, so I hope you enjoy the interview. Next up, a couple weeks, maybe a week or so, there'll be another actual Everyday Drinker episode where we'll sit down and have a good little party on the topic will be hard cider. But for now, the interview with Henry Price. If you could just explain to me, you know, an easy, what's your name and what do you do? And what are you going to bring for us today?
I'm Henry Price, and I'm the president and CEO of Price Imports. You know, we are a specialty liquor importer. We bring in most of the categories within the liquor industry, from single malt whiskeys to bourbons to liqueurs and specialty drinks. You know, about 15 years ago, we started phasing out of wines and focusing primarily on spirits.
Okay.
And it was mostly a survival kind of tactic. Because the wine business was just evolving too rapidly for us to get a grip on it and be a part of it that would have a meaningful, long-lasting business model for us.
Right.
And so doing the spirits became that. And then along the way, this mixology trend started taking off. And we happened to have a lot of brands that were being called for that follow the classic type of cocktails. And a lot of the new ones. I mean, these people are very, very creative, very creative. And so we ended up with a lot of, a lot of incredibly positive feedback from the industry for these products because they're available under one roof for one company.
Okay. And so where did you get your mixology expertise? Did you have to kind of learn this stuff, or did you watch other people, or was it all just field practice?
You know what? As an expert in mixology, I'm far from it.
Right.
But because of the products, I'm exposed to really talented people, be that Francesco Lafranconi, who's the national director of mixology for Southern Wine and Spirits, you know, the largest liquor distributor in the United States, Tony Abugaman, Dale DeGroff, you know, people with notoriety in the industry as being, you know, the top of their field. These people all come to us for the products because we have products they need for their cocktails. And so while I'm not a mixologist by a big stretch of the imagination, I've become exposed through our products and through these people to that trend and what's going on there. And it's very exciting.
Yeah. So more, not specifically that you would sit down and create the perfect cocktail, but you're looking at it from an industry point of view, saying, you know, being able to see from almost like a higher level what all these professionals and all these people are doing, which of course it rubs off because you get to, you know, learn it by absorbing what they're doing, which is kind of exciting. We're kind of in doing the same thing with our video show where we're creating cocktails. You know, my goal, and I had some specific pointy questions because I think from our audio shows and our video shows, we've had a bunch of different questions come up about mixing and about some of the rules and what not to do. And so, you know, I'm kind of hoping maybe to kind of pick some of that information out while we're talking as well, just to give as much information as possible. So one of the big things, and this came up right when I started creating cocktails, I said, well, maybe I need to be licensed for this, you know, maybe not necessarily because I care, but I felt that maybe the audience would expect me to have some sort of certification. And I decided, you know what, the show is called Common Man Cocktails. I wanted to create something that everybody could make. And I said, you know what? I don't think I need a license. I'll just see how it goes. And you learn a lot doing that. You learn a lot of things not to do and some things that taste good. And then you eventually start building your own cocktails using different spirits. So my question is, what is a bartender then? What is the difference between like a bartender and, say, a mixologist?
You know, I think, in my opinion and my observations over the last few years, the difference between a bartender and a mixologist is a bartender makes something to recipe that he's handed, you know, be that a Cosmo or whatever, whatever the standard drinks are there. Mixologists are like gourmet chefs. They see different products, and it starts evolving in their mind the picture of what they can do and what ingredients they can pull in. So they're a lot more like a gourmet chef versus a short order cook.
Right.
And it's a huge difference. I mean, when Francesco Lanfranconi from Southern Wine and Spirits, when he does a mixology event, he'll have an unbelievable amount of fresh ingredients on the bar. Everything is about the, you know, fresh mint leaves, fresh basil leaves, you know, fresh other herbs and fresh berries and fruits. And, you know, it's a lot more like the alcohol side of Jamba Juice, you know, where they
right.
put a combination and blends of things together that are very flavorful. And alcohol, what alcohol always does is alcohol adds that extra flavor kicker, you know, especially when it's done well. And that is, if there's a key thing I have personally learned, you know, so some of these cocktails, I start making them myself at events because they really feature our products well, you know, be that an Aviation or a Hemingway Daiquiri, because we're the U.S. importers for Luxardo Moschino. But if there's something I've really learned is you really don't deviate on those products that are flavor enhancers by adding too much of them. A lot of bartenders will go, hey, I'll give them an extra shot of this.
Right.
You know, if they're busy. You know, we had dinner the other night at a Cuban restaurant where they make the Hemingway daiquiris. I mean, that's where Hemingway first started drinking daiquiris, you know, in Cuba, and had a particular way he liked them. And they tied his name to it as the Hemingway daiquiri. But it was awful. It was just awful. And yeah, I had my business partners with me, and they go, I didn't have a very good drink. Yeah, well, one of the people in my company who has really taken to the mixology thing, and I told him about it, so he made a Hemingway daiquiri, made it the right way, and it's incredible. It's refreshing, it's beautiful, it's balanced. You know, when you're using a product like our Luxardo Maraschino, as much as I would love that to be a product you can put 2 ounces into a drink,
oh, no.
sell more product for us, it completely ruins it.
Oh,
you know,
yes.
It's about, yeah, and that is a big difference with the mixologists, and they have a real feel for those products. We hired for the San Diego Spirits Festival, we hired one of the mixologists from Bourbon Branch up in San Francisco, and we had a lot of our products on the bar because we set up a huge display, and then we had a number of cocktails we made. And so then I asked Eric, I said, so, you know, what goes on when, you know, you want to make a new cocktail? And he says, I look around at what's available to me, and it starts falling into place in my brain of I'll use a little of this and a little of that. And it's a little bit of chemistry and really knowing what flavors you're going to be working with or what base alcohols, you know, be that rum or vodka or gin or something, and having and knowing those balances, and then what fresh ingredients to enter into that. And I just keep being impressed by the drinks, or be that Adam Seeger out of Chicago from Nacional 27, who's incredibly creative with his infusions. And we're very impressed with these young guys.
Yeah, like the Maraschino, definitely in my opinion, when I first got it, I was like, okay, so I was imagining the maraschino cherry, right, the garnish, and I'm like, oh, it's going to be sweet. It's not. Like, this is an alcohol where you don't drink it straight just for fun. It's intense. But even if you put, it's very similar to a Sambuca in my mind, where when you add too much, it becomes the drink, and then you lose everything else, and you don't need a lot.
Well, it's very true. I mean, years ago, we were the importers of Jägermeister, and Sidney Frank did a brilliant job in building that brand. And along the way, you know, naturally, to always enhance the business model, they started coming up with cocktails for Jägermeister, and I tasted a few of them, and they all taste like Jägermeister.
Right.
You know, it's that flavorful of a product that you can put it with several other ingredients and make a cocktail, still tastes like Jägermeister. And the Luxardo Maraschino would be the same way. If you don't use it as, you know, a conservative ingredient, it takes over the drink. Right. And it is very powerful, and the reason it is that unlike, and this is another key ingredient for mixologists, it's all about quality. You're not going to make great cocktails with lousy liquor. And lousy liquor is just simply neutral spirits, essences, and sugar. And it's a difference in our triple sec from Luxardo. Our triple sec is made with full peel rinds from several varieties of oranges, three of them, you know, that are seeped and macerated with the oil from the rinds for almost a year. And so we end up with we have a higher proof.
Right.
We have the oils from the real rinds, and you distill that. And so you end up with a triple sec of immense flavor where you really can use less, and you're getting the real citrus flavor you want versus the cheap ones that are low in proof and just essences and sugar added to an alcohol.
But how do you market that? Because you're up against what everybody assumes. I expect I'm going to pay $6 to $8 for a triple sec, and I know it's going to be like a flavored Sprite with a little bit of like 17% alcohol. How do you get past that barrier and say, look, we're going to do something completely different and convince the general public to actually buy into that?
Well, you know, it's a real valid point. It's a very difficult proposition. It's usually one account at a time. You know, we find accounts that are making margaritas. They may be using our Chinaco, and we'll find out, you know, well, if you're using Chinaco and you're using an expensive tequila, how are you making it? You know, if it's simply that they're using agave nectar and lime juice, then fine, it's a very pure margarita, and that's their house style. More often than not, you know, most places find that having the drink slightly sweeter, you know, and with a different twist to it, they want to use a triple sec. So the better places use Cointreau. So they are already familiar with what a premium triple sec tastes like. And so then you introduce the Luxardo, and it's an over-the-top winner. We find that once people buy it, we've seen this in Texas. We have a very large a chain store operation in Texas that carries the Luxardo Maraschino, the Luxardo Orange Dry, and their volume keeps growing, and they're selling it all to consumers. Maybe you can drink our triple sec over the rocks. It's delicious because it's complex. It isn't overly sweet because of the alcohol. You know, you've got enough alcohol in there to take care of that. And so it is a slow process, but it's accelerating because what does help us is that there are a lot of people that are buying more of the premium products. And it's still not expensive. I mean, I know what you're saying, that paying $7-$8 versus paying $21-$22 is a big deal, but it's still an affordable type of luxury. And especially once they look at things, and you know, today people do look at, you know, you look at ingredient labeling, you look at the bottom, the Luxardo 78 proof, this other stuff's 34 proof. You're getting twice the product to begin with.
Right.
So if you go on that basis, it's not that much more expensive. It isn't triple the cost. You know, it's maybe 40% more. And it is a slow process, and we try to do some, because we don't have a lot of money for these brands, we try to do some targeted advertising, you know, with magazines like Imbibe magazine, you know, because they're very proactive in bringing these kind of products to the consumer. And the other thing is that, you know, a lot of the mixologists are using it, you know, the better known ones, they call us up and they go, look, we have an event. Can you donate a few bottles? And so then, you know, people are very influenced by what they see a mixologist making a drink with.
Right. Right.
So it is a slow process, but it's a real positive one.
So I need to get myself some of that then for our show. Cause that's something I haven't been exposed to that specific thing. And for me to look at, to compare to Cointreau is probably more appropriate. The trick I can only see there is because Cointreau itself is a name that people know, oh, Cointreau, yeah, that's a high-end orange liqueur. Triple sec is, you know, you got that stigma where it's going to be a low-end. So
I call it triple sec because mixologists understand it.
Right, right.
Typically, I refer to it as Luxardo Orange Dry.
Okay.
I mean, that's what triple sec is, sec is dry.
Right.
It's supposed to be extra dry. It's not extra dry in the cheap,
not even close now.
Thing. You know, so ours is very dry. It's very lean and flavorful and citrusy, and people get amazed by it. But you know, please send me an email. You know, we'd be glad to get you some bottles for the show.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. Because we did an orange liqueur tasting, which a lot of people had requested that we do, is let's lay them all out. So I used everything that had like an orange, and I used Tuaca. I had Triple Sec, Cointreau, Grand Marnier, Grand Gala. Like, we just put them all up against each other and said,
Did you get the Mandarin Napoleon in there?
I did not know. But yeah, we could do another show.
That's the Mandarin Napoleon. Now, that's tangerines.
Yeah.
And it's cognac-based, and it's phenomenal.
So,
You know, again, it's citrusy. It's not exactly orange.
Right.
But there's a lot of places that make a margarita. They call it the Rolls-Royce margarita, and they'll use the Mandarin Napoleon. Myself, it's the Mandarin is too powerful, but, you know, it has such an incredible, beautiful citrus flavor that it's quite interesting.
But that brings you like so much more to work with. Like when we were finished it, there were certain ones that, we also had blue Curacao in there just because it had that bitter orange.
We have the real one, by the way. We import the only genuine Curacao from the island of Curacao.
Oh, really?
Original Valencia oranges that were planted there by the Spanish explorers. And on the island, what happened is that the orange never developed. It has almost no fruit, and it's all skin. And so you've got this amazing, it's worthless for eating.
Right.
But from a distillation standpoint, you've got this over-the-top amount of peel with oils in it. And we bring in a clear, we bring in an orange, we bring in a blue, we have a rum raisin, we have a chocolate and a coffee Curacao. And that's the original orange. When Max Cointreau went to Curacao, he said, I want to buy the entire crop. And the Señor company said, no, you can't. We own it all.
Right.
And for years, I tried to get that brand because Curacao is another one of those knockoffs. You can't trademark a name of a place.
Right, right.
And so everybody just says Curacao. Ours is Señor Curacao from the island of Curacao.
So, yeah, the Curacao you get now is pretty much like the Triple Sec. It's about $5 to $7, and it's great for coloring. You don't get the bitter. Like when you taste it, like there might be some bitterness in there, but there's also an almost equally balanced sweetness that kind of, if you just said this is a bitter orange liqueur, you might figure it out. But if you don't say anything, I don't know if somebody will get that flavor profile from the ones that are being marketed today. And so,
part of it is that, you know, the flavors aren't distilled in. It's more of a compiling of ingredients, and then you're doing it at relatively low alcohol because that's how you keep the price cheap. So you don't have to, you know, be paying taxes to the government.
Right.
And you know, in the end, you know, you get what you pay for.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes, so it's true.
When you're making cocktails, I mean, you know, this is a never-ending argument, and the industry is certainly changing, and any place that's proud of the cocktails they make, really proud of them, you know, definitely it's not a hard argument. But, you know, they look at how much have they got invested in that drink, you know. So for each item like mine, that might cost them, you know, 10, 15 cents extra, you know. So instead of the drink costing, you know, a quarter in ingredient cost, it costs 75 cents. Yeah, and over the course of a year, you know, times the number of drinks that they make, it adds up without a doubt. But, you know, my argument is, you know, I'm in your restaurant. I'm paying $30 for my plate of food.
Right.
I'm paying $12, $13, $14 for a good drink, you know.
That's,
you know, isn't it
yeah.
fair to expect that my drinks are the same quality as the food?
And for the $15, like, and I became more aware of this as I started expanding to different brands and tastings and doing more of my own cocktails, because homemade cocktails by far blow away what you can get in an average restaurant where people just are doing like the off the shelf stuff. They're adding extra alcohol. They're doing whatever they can to get it off the bar into your table. They're the drinks tend to be more flavorful, but if I'm going to spend $6 to $12 on a drink, I can be aware of what's inside of it. Like if I go to a restaurant and I order a margarita and it's going to be sweet sour mix and Cuervo Gold, I pass. I don't want that drink because I'm paying more money than is worth it in my time. I can go home after dinner and make that same drink 1,000 times better.
Plus, and why do you want to put that in your body anyway? You know, it's pure sugar
and grain alcohol.
It's pure sugar and grain alcohol. You're using corn syrup for the sweetener. You know, it's just garbage. You know, which is another thing. Sometimes you know they miss at the bar is that when you're using all these pre-made products and the corn syrups are in there and all these sugars, you know, that along with alcohol that converts to sugar in your system, you're really boosting what the alcohol is doing. So you end up, somebody that might have a second drink probably will pass, you know, because it hits you harder. It also fills you up. Sugar satisfies that craving.
Right.
And, you know, that's why we, in our own cocktails that we make at any of the events we do, it's an expensive ingredient, but we import a grape sugar syrup. It's a very exotic product. It's no more money than agave nectar, but it's much more neutral because it's grape sugar. It's a fruit sugar. It's a complex sugar. So your body breaks it down very, very slowly, just like agave nectar.
Right. I love agave nectar.
And, you know, well, you'd love our grape sugar syrup because it enhances any drink that needs some sweetness, and it enhances the ingredient in that drink. You know, the process on the, it's the Pages, it's made by the Pages company in France for us. And created by a gentleman that has a lot of vineyards. And in France, you're limited to, and in a lot of countries, you're limited to how much tonnage you can bring off that vineyard. And yeah, he was tired of throwing away the extra grapes. Came up with a process where he flash heats the grapes, that brings the sugar out. He then crushes them very quickly, prevents any fermentation to the juice, by keeping yeast away from it, and runs it through an osmosis system where they remove all the water and all that's left. It tastes like it's like a late harvest wine.
Yeah, or an ice wine.
Yeah, like an ice wine. There's no complexity here. It's just the sugars.
Right, right.
But it actually tastes very good. Now, boy, when you make cocktails with it, the thing you'll notice immediately, it's very easy to drink an extra cocktail or two with this product as a sweetener, be that a mint julep, or we use it in every cocktail we make, you know, around the offices or in our events because we import it. It's very hard to sell. You know, it's probably $12, $13 a bottle, and that's a lot of money to pay for a sweetener. But I don't view it as a sweetener as much as a major ingredient in an absolutely excellent cocktail. And we don't get any arguments on that, but it's hard to beat, you know, a simple syrup at $2-3 a bottle.
Well, for a simple syrup, I just make it because it's like almost free at that point. I think that one of the big things, and I hope we lead this way, is we're moving in general, it seems to be, away from the artificial high fructose corn syrup products. And we, I think as a culture, at least in the United States, seem to be preparing ourselves for paying a little more, which I do at the grocery store. I buy fresh fruits, you know, for my kids and everything. I don't buy all the sugary foods that I had when I was a kid. And it's an expensive endeavor. But as we grow to understand that this is probably better for our bodies to just spend a couple extra dollars, it works the same way in cocktails. Because when people leave a party that I've thrown, and I've had some ones where people have left in a way that they had to be carried, and when they wake up the next day, they know, okay, I probably went a little overboard, but nobody wakes up with a blazing migraine. They wake up as if they were very cloudy because it was a rough night, but they can get up, they can get on a plane, they can fly out, they could do, you know, whatever they need to do. It's a slower day, but they still come back and they're like, look, I don't know, what did you do that you made these cocktails that didn't make me want to die the next day? And I was like, look, I'm using fresh cut oranges, limes, lemons, agave nectars, you know, pretty basic stuff.
Yeah, you're getting you're getting vitamin C, you know, you're getting fiber, you're getting you're getting things that are generally good for you along with the alcohol. And I agree, you know, it's you know, we sell a lot of different alcohols, and I'll admit that there's been time I may have had a drink or two too many, but yeah, we don't, There's nobody that wakes up with headaches on these drinks, you know, because, again, you know, the sweetener we use doesn't slam your body, you know. It's a big deal. It's why a margarita made with, you know, the agave nectar, you know, it's a whole different ballgame. I mean, we have a place in Nevada that uses Chinaco exclusively for all their house drinks, and they make them with the agave nectar, you know, and it's they sell a lot of drinks. I mean, the person can come back. If they're a one-drink person, they come back for a second. If they're a two-drink, they come back for a third. They get that extra drink because they're using that extra better ingredient. Now, that profit margin on there sure offsets the using agave nectar instead of some cheap sweet and sour mix.
Right. And then it's not that they just come back, though, for that second drink. They come back another week. They might bring friends and be like, no, you really need to check. This is the best margarita you're ever going to have.
And that's very true.
And they don't necessarily know why. You know, they might ask. Some people ask. They ask me, like, you know, well, I always make my margaritas with a little bit of Cointreau or Grand Marnier or some orange. And sometimes people don't like that, so you take it out. But then I use agave nectar, lime, in 100% de agave tequila. And people are like, what did you do? This is not like I've gotten it at a restaurant and I'm paying a lot more for it. I'm like, well, look, it's not hard. It's just there's this extra ingredient that people... they put in artificial sweeteners, or they use a sweet sour, which if you look at the ingredient list, the first thing on there is high fructose corn syrup, and you get that artificial sweet taste. It doesn't taste diety or anything. It just tastes super thickly sweet. Like, you get that stickiness on your tongue where you don't get that with these other more subtle sweeteners.
No, it's, you know, it's interesting. I was at a restaurant in San Diego the other night, and they make a drink there, called the Castro Cooler. It's rum, fresh squeezed blood oranges. There is Luxardo bitter in there. And there's one other ingredient. I don't know if it's a triple sec or not. It's a delicious drink, you know, So you're probably getting 4 ounces of alcohol, and it is a substantially large drink, and it just goes down so smooth, so good. You know, and there's a lot of blood oranges in there, very flavorful, but refreshing. It never ceases to amaze me when you find the places, and people go to this place. It's a very small place in the area of Hillcrest, a little bit of northeast of the city of San Diego. And, people come in there for the drinks. They come in because of the drinks. And so people come back there. Now, you're in New York, right?
I'm in New Hampshire. About 4 hours.
Oh, in New Hampshire. Okay, yeah. I mean, in New York, it's, there's just so many places that have bought into the premium drinks. I mean, it's all over that city. You know, people go out a lot there, and so there is a lot of competition, without a doubt, for places where you're going to end up. And so a lot of places make them terrific drinks. And, you know, you mentioned it earlier, and it's so true. You know, people, they don't get the headaches, you know. But just like people come back to restaurants because a particular restaurant food is something they really love, you know, when those places are making good, high-quality drinks, they add another notch to their belt. You know, not only have they got great food, they've got great cocktails.
Right.
And great drinks. And it takes a lot of effort on those bartenders because if it's just margaritas, that's one thing. They perfect it. But a lot of those places have to make, you know, lots and lots of different cocktails because that's what they're famous for.
Right.
And the bartenders really have to, you know, the bartender mixologists, they really have to get it down. They really have to experiment and know what they're doing because when, you know, you're a place like Employees Only in New York City, which is only 1,200 square feet, but they did about $4.5 million in cocktails last year. It's the highest volume cocktail lounge in the United States. You get slammed over and over and over with a lot of different requests for different cocktails, and you really, you know, have to know what you're doing. You have to have everything ready to go, and at that place, everything's about quality ingredients.
Right, so you can't.
And that's how they do that business.
Right, you can't take shortcuts. You've got to go all out. But now, do you see that changing? Like, the alcohol industry, maybe once upon a time was. It seems that it goes in cycles. We have these really great cocktails and ideas, and it gets all watered down. Then we get back to the basics again. Where do you see the mixology or the cocktail scene going in the next 10 years, 15 years? Do you think it's going to continue to ramp up to the quality cocktails regardless of economic issues?
You know, it's a good point. It's a really good point. I'm glad you asked. You know, and I was at an event last night, and we talked about that at the event I was at. There's a dynamics in play here that's different. And, you know, I've been in the business for 35 years. I started with selling wines. You know, my generation was the generation that built the wine business in the U.S. that's so large today.
Right.
And wine was everything. Today's younger people, the 25 to 35 age group, they drink premium beer, they drink good wines, and they drink cocktails. You know, unlike my generation, I mean, we hardly drank a cocktail. I mean, you know, we'd want a glass of Chardonnay or a glass of Riesling or whatever it is. You know, we drank wine. And from what I've seen at the tails of the cocktail and the number of people, young people that are there and the enthusiasm they display, I really think that this is, it isn't like it started yesterday. It started over the last 6, 7, 8 years. It's a trend that's here for a long time to stay because you are picking up a group of consumers that, like myself, that was, you know, my younger days in the business were centered around wine. I did a lot of wine seminars. I imported a lot of wines and, you know, wine. A lot of these younger people that are in the business, it's about cocktails.
Right.
And they're promoting cocktails, and they like teaching about cocktails, and they like talking about it. And so you are building a business that I think is here for a very long time to come. Those people that are indoctrinated into these quality cocktails are not going to go back and be happy with a regular Cosmo or, you know, a lousy margarita made with, you know, with a mix. They're not going to be interested. They're
right.
Just not going to be interested.
But there's an advantage, though. It's cheaper in the end because I can't blend my own wines at my house and I can't make my own. Well, I can make my own beers, but it's a lot of work. I can blend my own cocktails and spend a little extra for all the ingredients, but I get more than one drink out of it.
And that is an advantage. But on the other hand, too, I know I've been to places where they have such an array of fresh ingredients, you're never going to have them at your house. But if you have a party, you go out and make a specific effort to buy those ingredients. And, you know, and that's why you go to restaurants. It's not that you can't cook good food at home, but they have a way of doing it. They make a particular meal you like. And I think that, you know, as the economy improves a little bit, you know, I still see even now, as tough as the economy is, the places that put the extra energy in, they're busy. They're busy. You know, they take business from someplace else. But, you know, there is less business without a doubt.
Right.
But it's a matter of who's going to get that business. You know, people are very conscious about the money they spend. They want to bang for their buck. You know, we like to call it affordable luxuries. People still have a certain amount of discretionary income. Who's going to get that money? And there's less of it to go around. Well, it's going to be those places that give you the biggest bang for your buck and, you know, give you a good cocktail. This place I was talking about in San Diego, I like Campari and soda. That's a nice, refreshing aperitif for me. Well, then since they carry Luxardo bitter, I can order it with Luxardo, you know, and it's $6. I don't remember the last time I went out in San Diego and only paid $6 for a cocktail. And this was a big, you know, Luxardo bitter and soda. It wasn't a little one. It was huge. It was huge. There's probably 4 ounces of alcohol in there.
So do you think they brought the price? Do you think they know that they can't command a high price for it even, regardless and just take a little out of the margin?
For Campari. It's the same price for Campari and soda. You know, I know they carry our Luxardo, so I order it, but it's the same price.
Right.
For Campari. I think that they've just said to themselves, this is a fair price. You know, and consequently, they sell a lot of cocktails.
And I was at a restaurant the other day that has normal cocktails, nothing, you know, it was just a regular Italian restaurant, and I don't think cocktails were their strong point, but their cocktails really were about $8 to $9, and that was for, you know, your very basic, like gin martinis and stuff. You're still paying $8 for a gin martini, yeah. Which is not a, you're not getting a lot. You might get 3 ounces of gin and an olive, right? I don't see at that price point spending the money. I would rather buy something I've never had that lists off some ingredients and you go, that tastes, you know, blood orange. Never had a blood orange, then fine. This is something I totally want to try, right? You want to get a little experimentation going. It's not like you're ordering a fish and you don't like fish. This is just a cocktail. It might not be your favorite, but at least you've expanded yourself a little bit.
Yeah, very true. And it's where the cocktail revolution's at. And it's San Diego's a bedroom community town. And then we've made it a real project because our offices are located there to find places. And there's getting to be places that are that have people in there, young people. They're really interested in making great cocktails, and they're looking at our products and using them. And so even in places like San Diego, which are not like L.A. or New York or San Francisco that are, you know, bastions of great cocktails, there's people down there bringing the scene to the people. And, you know, I hope it succeeds. It's harder in some of those places. You know, New York, it's easy. You know, who drives to the bar, right? Either right. walk or you take the underground or the bus. So you can always drink two or three and have a nice, safe ride home. It's harder in Southern California where everything's a drive.
Right.
And things. But nonetheless, you know, people have their drink and you sell them quality and you have, they have a reason to come back. They have a reason to say, wow, that was so good there. And I really like that. You know, I mean, I can make a smoothie at home, yet I stop in the Jamba Juice and pick one up. You know, so it's not hard to make a smoothie at home. But, you know, you don't have to clean anything up. You don't have to have the ingredients there. You just go into Jamba Juice and get one.
If you're building a cocktail, like either you're designing one or you're, I don't know, you're doing it at home because it's cold out or maybe it's snowing or, well, for us, it might be snowing. what would you consider to be like the main components? When somebody takes your alcohols and builds them together, what are the major components that they use when they build one of these like really good quality cocktails? Are there like three specific ingredients or did it just go crazy?
No, you know, when you go crazy, I think it the drink becomes crazy.
Like Scorpion
Bowl. Yeah, I mean, you know, I'll give you one that we've really been pushing a lot because it features two great products from us, and it's three great products from us, which is the Aviation Cocktail. You know, we use Old Raj Gin, which is an incredible gin. I mean, it has so much flavor, so many botanicals in there. It's very, very forward, dry flavored gin. The Luxardo Maraschino, and then our Apage Svidren Creme de Violette. And so those are items that you need for a classic aviation, you know, and your sweetener, which we use the grape sugar syrup. So it really uses all our ingredients. And then a Luxardo cherry, which is a real Marasca cherry instead of a fluorescent one. So the whole entire cocktail is made with our ingredients. So alcohol-wise, you've got three alcohols in there, and you know, you've got a sweetener and a cherry. And it's a delicious cocktail. We were asked to, I don't know if you're familiar with the show on Showtime called Weeds.
Ah, yes.
And they featured in some of the scenes the Luxardo products, and they had some Luxardo posters up in a bus stop, and they had Chinaco tequila and things. And so, you know, part of the trade out there was that we would do their wrap party with a bar featuring the products that they used within the show. And so we made the Aviation. We had a bar. We were just there for a little over 2 hours. We served 300 aviations.
So you have a few bartenders there.
You just, you know what? I pre-mixed them. I learned how to do that from Francesco. You know, you take a half-gallon container with a spigot on it, and you just multiply out, you know, the ounces of each product so that you know exactly what to put in.
Oh,
and the fresh-squeezed. Oh, yeah, there was one other thing in there. It's the fresh-squeezed lemon juice. I forgot. We need fresh-squeezed lemon juice. You know, so we squeeze the lemon juice, and you know, you just do it all. You just do all the right proportions. And it turned out perfect. I learned that from Francesco, because when you're doing those kind of events, you're either an amazing bartender and going crazy, you know, or you come up with something else. And so it worked great. I had one helper, and we had it ready to go. We took it out of the spigot over ice in a cup and then dropped in the Luxardo cherry and went through 300 of them. It was crazy. It was unbelievable. And they'd never experienced an aviation, none of those people. I mean, here they are in show business and, you know, certainly financially, nothing's holding them back. It's a very successful show.
Right.
And I can't tell you how many, we had little postcards printed with the recipe and the product so that if they took it, they could go out and find it. And a lot of people say, you know, where can I get it here or there and things, you know, so they want to make them at home too.
That's the key blocking point for what I've seen from, like, when I do a cocktail, typically my goal is to try and find ingredients that are either widely available or can be substituted with something of equal quality. But I've seen some mixology recipes that I can't buy 50% of the ingredients for. Like, what do you, I mean, how, is there any solution to that, or do you just have to
go someplace else. No, that's very true. I mean, you know, Adam Seeger in Chicago is he's pretty exotic with a lot of his cocktails, and he puts a lot of energy into making some of the ingredients or getting them ready. He'll do that a day or two before. You know, you're not going to be able to go and buy those. You have to prepare them yourself and go through the process. Unfortunately, and I mean, I know exactly what you're saying, really great stores that just carry all that stuff are so far and few between. Most liquor store owners are still a little bit closed-minded because they don't really understand what's going on out in the mixology scene. They're not catering to it.
Exactly.
Here they have this enormous opportunity, but they're not catering to it. You know, we do business with Specs in Houston, Texas.
Right.
They
buy
over 200 products from us. There isn't anything you can't get at that store, nothing. And consequently, per store, per unit, they sell more of our products than anybody else in the United States.
I could see that, because Specs is most of the different alcohol companies I've dealt with, like Cavallino Tequila, and some of the smaller vendors that are, not vendors, but people that are bringing out their own unique blends of spirits, they can't, they're all there. They're all at Specs because they carry like everything. And they're mainly, especially for tequila, tends to be more towards the Texas area anyway, I think. So they, it's an easy access for them. Where
yeah,
up
they
here,
have 60 stores.
Yeah.
I know. It's. I mean, let me tell you, in Connecticut, I beat my head against the wall to try to get some of the stores up there to carry the stuff. You know, and we have a distributor up there, and you know, New York's tough too because New York store space is really premium. You know, and so if you've got a small store, you know, initially you're going to go with all the big international brands from the big companies because it's just the easy
right.
route.
You're going to have your Patron.
You know?
But I want something. I want orange bitters, for instance. I can't get those anywhere. How is that not possible? Like, I go to a Massachusetts, maybe 30, 40 minutes outside of Boston, and they carry all kinds of neat ingredients. They didn't have the Maraschino Luxardo. I had them special order it for me because that was what it was. It came down to if they don't have it, you can special order it, but that's going to add additional overhead for the cost. So now I'm paying extra because I only bought two. And if I don't know what I need, I can't browse because it's not there. So
yeah, and you know, part of that is that our distributor there also is a little bit weak. You know, it's an unfortunate set of circumstances. The big guys there didn't want to handle us. We're with a company called Atlantic, and Atlantic is tied in. You know, in they allow you to have retail licenses and distributor licenses in that state. So the people that own Marty's own Atlantic. And hey, I'm thrilled they carry our product because the other big guys didn't want to put them in.
Right.
And but they're not that strong in getting out to all the accounts, or other accounts say, I don't want to buy from them. They own a retail shop and I'll have to compete against them.
Right.
And when you're really not competing, you know, people aren't going to drive across town to save a buck a bottle on something. You know, it's too expensive these days, time and gas, you know. So it's about you looking at your own business, your own store, knowing what's going on in the business and stocking the store as such.
Right. That's, you know, I think the big issue is they don't know what's going on in the business. Like, I would enjoy it if I went to a liquor store. Now in New Hampshire, it's more challenging because we're a control state, so we get whatever we get.
New Hampshire is really tough.
Yeah. And so, but I'm right on the border, so I could jump right over into Mass. But I would like to be able to walk into a liquor store, a package store, whatever you call it, and have a corner, an edge piece, or I can't remember what they call the things on the edges, that just maybe each week feature a completely different cocktail, and all the ingredients are right there for you to buy. If you know,
they call them end caps.
An end cap, right. So if you want an aviation, boom, you put it on an end cap, but they wouldn't know to do that unless they go out and see what is being created, what are some trends, you know, watch some shows like mine or whatever and go, hey, that's a pretty good idea. How do we get that? They might already have the ingredients, but you're not inspiring the people, the general public, to get creative if they don't know what's going on, and especially in these little satellite states where we're not in New York or we're not in a trendy area, you don't know. But you would, if you had it, you'd be like, wow, that's really great. I'm glad you did that. And next week have something different. Then people will come to your store because they're like, what do they get this week? You know, and try something a little different. Maybe that'll happen eventually if people keep making special order requests.
You know, I think, you know, you hit on something that's got my own mind stirring a little bit. You know, because we sell every single ingredient to make an aviation, and the original aviation is made with Luxardo Maraschino, we should put I might just talk to my graphics guy and have him put a flyer out there you know, that we can use with our distributors in the trade and offer them the entire package and say, here it is. This is what you need. Do an end cap display, and these are the products you need to order, and you don't have to order a ton of them. But now you can do your aviation, all the ingredients for an aviation, and do aviation week at a particular store with a little spot taken up for it. It's a good idea.
Yeah, well, people, first off, sometimes I find that some, like my audience, they're not necessarily lazy, but they're not in the know about specific things. And that's why they're watching this show. They want to see what are the brands. What can I make? When I go to a liquor store, there's labels. There's, you know, bottle labels are marketing, and they're looking at it going, well, there's 7,000 vodkas, there's 6,000 tequilas, there's 20,000 gins or whatever, and which one do I get? What can I make with this? And they don't know. They'll gladly make anything you say this is good. People will try it, but if they can't find it, how are they supposed to go searching? They don't know what they're looking for. So, you know, give people that. An outlet, or get people being creative, which is what I'm trying to do. Is say, look, you can make these 50 drinks, but don't stop there. Now you have some ideas. You know what the flavors are. Maybe you like a lot of pineapple juice, or maybe you like a banana liqueur. What can you do with the banana liqueur, pineapple juice, and tequila? You know what can, and you might invent something that's already been created, but that gets their process thinking. Right now, they're not thinking.
Yeah, it's very true, and you know, and some of the, unfortunately, you know, a lot of times independents complain about larger operators, but we started doing a lot of business with Total Wine and More, and when Total Wine at first wanted to do everything private label, they like to own everything, and we pointed out to them that if they do that, then they're going to really have to develop for all those private labels. They have to develop all their own business.
Right,
because they're not going to get those people that watch your show or been to a bar, that see those brands. They're not going to have the same faith in the store's private brand as being the right ingredient to make those drinks.
Right.
So they go, you know, you're right. We're not going to sell enough of those, and they put in about 150 of our product. You know, so now Total Wine and More isn't everywhere, but they're, I think, in 6 or 7 states now, and they're putting in a lot of our products in all those states where they can. You know, and it's selling well. It's selling very well for them. And so, you know, the little guys complain. You know, now the good little guys don't complain. There's a store in Costa Mesa, California called High Time Wine and Spirits that doesn't have to worry about anybody, big or large, you know, I mean, big or small, they don't have to worry about anyone because they carry it all. They're like a one store Specs, and they just carry it all. And people can, it's a one-stop shop. You know, you need bitters, you need gins, you need, you know, and they have people in the store that can help guide you. You know, they go, well, you know, I saw this or that being made, you know. But, oh, yeah, you know, if they don't have it, they'll make sure they get it and get it quickly.
That's the big issue, though, is the guiding. That whole guiding thing is key. Like, if you go into a store and you tell me this is all the stuff I carry, but you don't know anything about it, that doesn't really help me unless I know what I'm there for.
And that's, by the way, something that Total prides themselves in is training their people. You know, you go into a Total Wine and More, and the people, you know, the people that are knowledgeable. They don't want to hound you. They just want to help you. And they have everything in the stores. And so, you know, boom, boom, boom. You're able, same at Specs. They have knowledgeable people, you know. And, I mean, in the end, there's no secret here. You know, people will always complain, well, I can't really get people to do that. Well, for one, you got to pay them. You know, no,
nice.
You're not going to get one at minimum wage. It's going to stick around there for very long. You got to let it, you know, you got to pay them enough that it can be a career, and they should be able to pay for themselves. And that education part of it is what does that. That's why we go to school. You know, for those that didn't go to college and things like that, doesn't mean they're stupid, but they may have found that, you know, working in a liquor store is their thing. They've got to know what the heck they're doing. So many of them don't. They just stock the shelves with what the big liquor guys tell them to stock it with. And they don't have any idea why.
Right, which
is a serious
problem.
You know, so that means they're totally dependent. They're totally, I mean, it's the same thing in New Hampshire in the liquor control states. They function like those idiotic stores that just put in a few of the big products, you know, instead of saying to themselves, you know, shouldn't we have 2 or 3 stores in the state of New Hampshire that just carry almost everything that's out there? And to have somebody intelligent that does the buying for those stores that is informed about what's going on in the liquor industry.
But they're behind.
Well.
They're behind because they do have that exact thing for wine. If you go to a store, there's a store in Nashua, New Hampshire. First, there's 3 stores in Nashua, New Hampshire. And one thing I like about the control state, or at least in New Hampshire, is you at least know what you're getting when you go to any of them. And they have a nice website that tells you their stock and everything. But when you go into this one Nashua store, there's one in Salem too. They have it's like dominated by wines. Every type of wine you can want. Great prices on them too. And you're like, well, if you're into wine, that's the store you go to. But like you said, that was a different generation. Now you get people coming into cocktails, then they can do. There's nothing to stop them from having one of those other two stores be like the go-to place for cocktails. That might be accessories. Yep. I want shakers. I want some jiggers. I want the bitters. I want some stirrers. I want everything to do with cocktails. I want to be able to walk in there and buy it all.
Yep.
And maybe 10 years.
There's not a lot of stores, by the way, across the whole United States that do that.
I can't get a Boston Shaker anywhere, not even Amazon. So, you know, it's like a three-week wait period. I'm like, this is not rocket science. It's a piece of steel with a glass. How hard is this? Why is this so difficult? But the demand is growing.
But I think you do point out there's guys like you that are, you know, doing the show, doing the interview. There's a lot of mixologists out there. We just happen to be, the frustration is that it isn't moving quicker, but the reality is that we're at the beginning of a movement. So when people say that, you know, well, how long do you think this is going to last or just peter out? I go, my God, you know, it's going to take 10 years for the movement to get up to a speed that what you're asking for actually starts showing up.
Right.
You know, and yes, eventually it will peak. It'll peak because there's always something new. That's what life is all about. But along the peaking, I mean, wines have essentially peaked. But, you know, along the process, America's become one that's not already the largest per capita consumers of wine in the world. You know, I remember when I was young in this business and, you know, we were always a fraction of what people consumed of wine versus Italy or France. Not anymore. We're like number one or two now. You know, so, it's peaked. That does make the challenges within that industry harder. But we have a long way to go before we peak out on the cocktail and the ingredients and those kind of things being available, where you can walk into a store, even your corner liquor store or control state that has a cocktail store center, where, you know, they may never have everything, but there's products you have to have.
Right.
You know, you got to have somebody's Velvet Falernum. You know, you got to have Luxardo Maraschino. You have to have, maybe not Pagès Creme de Violette, but there aren't a lot of Creme de Violettes right now. That's why we pushed hard to get one.
Yeah.
You know, you have to have those products. Those are products where when you go, even if you know nothing about the liquor business, but you pick up a handful of cocktail books and you start breaking down what you really have to have, things start showing up. You know, you got to have Cointreau. You know, you got to have Grand Marnier. You have to have Mandarin Napoleon. These are classic products. These are not products somebody just invented yesterday. These go into classic cocktails, and classic cocktails are back. And mixologists are taking the classic and adding a new exciting twist to it. You know, I mean, cocktails weren't this good when I was younger.
Well, what is, okay, then maybe you can explain this. What's the deal with Europe? Like, I have a lot of viewers, because it's internet, it's the international thing going on. And most of my viewers, they can get all the big brands, like no problem with Bacardi, right? No problem with Patron, maybe actually they could be. But they come to me and they're like, okay, so what can I use instead of Crusion or instead of this other brand, because we only have a small selection. They have like two brands of everything. In tequila, they don't even have any 100% de agave tequila in it. Like I have viewers in anywhere from Lithuania to Austria, and they're like, yeah, we don't have that.
No, it's starting. I mean, I just sent some samples to Russia of our tequila, so it's starting. But they're way behind. You know, you're one country where you've got the selection pretty readily available, probably not as good as the United States. There's no replicating the United States. We may have complaints and issues, but there's no place the selection of products we have exists anywhere. But England is close. England is close. They have an amazing cocktail culture in London.
Right,
guys like Simon Gifford, who've written God knows how many books on the culture and drinks and so on. So you in London, yes, you know, but if you get outside of London, no, forget it. You know, I mean, London.
What's the, is it the import export taxes? Is it the different guides, rules and regulations for each country, or are they just behind the, is it just, they haven't caught up to this trend yet?
No, I don't, you know, it's a good question. I mean, I don't do business over there, but I've traveled over there a lot. Each one of those countries, I don't care if it's Germany, Austria, you know, all those countries produce liquor products that are well known in their country.
Right.
Around those products there's some cocktails and whatever desserts and different things that use alcohol or a particular drink. You know, in Austria, they have Stroh rum. They make what they call Jägertee, you know, which is a hunter's tea, which is, you know, it's a way of enjoying the rum in a hot drink. But, you know, they don't venture much past that. There are not good distribution channels for doing the variety of products that we do in the U.S. The distribution channels just aren't there, and the interest isn't there. It has gotten there for products like single malts, but, you know, that doesn't help somebody that wants to do cocktails.
Right. And, like, you know, it's Red Bull and vodka. Obviously, Austria can pull that off because they've got vodka, and they, I believe, created Red Bull. So, you know, there's those drinks. But I just notice from my viewers, people want this. They do. They're like, well, I do want that.
Well,
but
sure. You know, but, I mean, that's why, you know, that's why the Japanese now have so many of the things that we have in America. They always fell in love with what we do. And, you know, they took pictures like crazy. They wanted to replicate what we do. You know, in Levi jeans, you know, I remember being when I was younger, you know, my God, can you bring me a pair of Levi jeans? And they're hard to get in Europe. you know, they're not hard to get anymore, but, you know, that trend has moved on to designer jeans.
Right.
But, you know, they are behind, and they don't have the distribution channels, and they don't, you know, they're just not as open-minded and as adventuresome, nor do they, you know, the demographics, the way that they're spread out are different. That's why it works in London. It's a cosmopolitan big city, lots of places to hang out, and so it works well. You know, in Berlin, you know, my guess is in Berlin you'd find a pretty, you know, you would find good bars.
Right.
You know, you would find good bars. And it's also distributors are, you know, in America we tend to have very large distributors that dominate the scene. And through those large distributors, you get broad ranges of products. Europe doesn't typically tend to have really large distributors, and you have a lot more smaller distributors covering regions. And so you're going to get a little more inconsistency for the distribution of those kind of products. And also because they don't maybe import for as large an area. When we import for the whole United States.
Right.
We're exclusive distributors of these products in the U.S. We could take a different view than if we just had Southern California.
Totally, yeah.
And in Europe, it tends to be more like that. You know, you're assigned a smaller territory that's your exclusive territory for those brands. And so they tend to zero in on, again, sort of like the more boring stores here, those big brands that they get their hands on. So it's a very different distribution dynamic over in Europe.
Here's a question I've had some people ask, and I've seen some weird odd behavior in this, but what are your thoughts on vodka? Because you've already said that you find that there's all these little subtle flavors in each of these drinks, but vodka, at least U.S.-based and largely around anything high marketing, is all about crisp, clean, no flavor, just like, you know, 40% alcohol. Do you see mixologists using it?
Yeah, you know, we have one vodka. We do nothing with it. You know, we ourselves, you know, well, I mean, from a mixology standpoint, they don't want to talk about vodka. I mean, none of those guys want to talk about vodka. It's a base alcohol. They do carry the big brands because people will walk in and go, oh, I got to have Grey Goose, or I got to have this, or I got to have that. You know, but that's sort of an unsophisticated buyer anyway.
Right.
The more sophisticated buyer that's already moved on and it has particular cocktails they like or things that they like, they want, you know, they have their gins or their tequilas and, you know, or their favorite drinks and so on. So, you know, vodka is really a base alcohol in the purest sense. There's hardly a reason for more than one brand to exist.
Right. Now, it seems that there's a few million, where my personal preference is Tito's because I can't find anything that competes in price, and I don't want to say lack of flavor, but that's kind of where that's the target is. They want a nice, clean finish. They don't want it to burn too much. They want it to be a good quality vodka for those that have a perception of what good quality vodka is. And it's less money. They don't put a lot of work into the bottle design. Then there's other people who are all about Absolut or Grey Goose or whatever.
Tito's is good. And, you know, and I mean, it points up, though, that, you know, people have their favorite brands. And that's if they're, you know, while I say there isn't a lot of reason to have more than one, people have their favorite brands. And it tends to be, it's one of the easiest products in the sense of that you could either make a fancy bottle or a simple bottle, but nothing's easier to distill than vodka.
Right. So that's an odd misconception.
It's the most basic, it's the most basic of alcohols to distill. You know, you either use grain or beets or grapes or whatever, you know, and, you know, you ferment and distill. And how you distill, you know, has part of the effect on it, and, you know, how many columns, or, you know, you finish it off in a pot still. I mean, you can play different games, but vodka is the most basic of alcohols you can make. So it's sort of, you know, you want to be, I mean, you look at all the craft distillers in the United States, the first product that makes another vodka.
Right. And which, you know, we need
like,
more.
Like, oh my God, you know, I mean, more vodkas are, you know, why does anybody think they're going to have a vodka that's going to be more interesting than the other 600 that are out there?
Right, because it has a cool reflective pattern in the back or something. But, it, you know, okay, so that's normal. That is, it's not a, my imagination. Mixologists tend to stay away from that. And
oh, hey, at the tails of the cocktail in July, you know, the four-letter word was vodka. Don't even bring it up. You know, it's like, you know, it's like it's a yawn. It's like, you know, don't bore me. You know, that's not, you know, vodka is just, you know, whichever vodka they happen to have at their bar, and they're going to be picky about the ones they like the best for their drinks that call for a vodka. But it's not something they want to talk about. That's just a base alcohol. That's it.
No.
For the big companies, it's something they throw a lot of money at because it is the largest category of spirits sold, because it's also the simplest and it goes into the most drinks. So, you know, there is a lot of business there, and there's always somebody wanting to chase those big guys that have that business. My experience has been chasing those guys is costly, unprofitable, and your chance of success is very, very slim.
Right.
Because you're not doing really anything, you're not doing anything exciting and new. You know, you're chasing somebody in a category that's been around as long as distilled spirits have been around.
Is that why they're all going flavored now? Because I don't know, it seems in the last 5 to 6 years, it went from having a couple, like maybe a Smirnoff and a three Olives going, they're almost known more for blueberry vodkas, raspberry vodkas, citrus vodkas. There's so many different flavors of vodka that it seems that that's their solution, is to say, okay, we understand it's got no taste, so what we're going to do is we're going to make, basically, it's a alcoholic juice out of our vodka.
Well, it's more about shelf position and line extensions. It's, you know, if you have a relatively strong brand and you come out with a fruit flavor, whatever the popular fruit flavor happens to be, then all your distributors will buy it, all your stores will put it in and give it a try. So it becomes a line extension. It becomes a way to offset that your regular vodka, your straight vodka brand, is at a standstill in growth. And sometimes it sticks, sometimes it doesn't. You know, to me, again, that's always a mystery. If you want raspberry in your vodka, why would you do an artificial flavor? Why don't you get your vodka and put real raspberries in it?
Right.
Muddle them.
Which is very tasty, by the way, raspberries.
You know, or get a raspberry puree if you don't want to muddle, and add a few drops to your vodka. At least you've got something pure rather than an essence that came out of a chemistry lab.
Exactly.
To me, that's a mystery, but I understand the business dynamics of it. The line extension in our industry is a big, big deal. You know, be that a if you've got very successful with a 750 ml of a particular whiskey and it's selling very, very well, well, maybe it's time to step up to a 1.75 liter because all your distributors will then bring it in and it'll get pushed into the stores. And without having done anything new and fancy, you've increased your business.
That's a good point.
And so it's called line extension. And it's, you know, and sometimes it's very valid. Sometimes it's a desperation move. You know, there's lots of different reasons. You know, I mean, these big companies have well laid out business plans and they look at the market and the statistics and, you know, they know why they do it. But it is, you know, at the bottom line is it's called a line extension, and it's extra multiplication of increase in business.
Speaking of more a marketing thing, maybe I'm thinking that's what this is, but do you understand or perhaps know the history behind why certain cocktails have such weird, dirty names? Like, for instance, Sex on the Beach, Orgasm, they get a whole lot worse than that. Is that a marketing thing, or...
I really hate that. I personally, I hate it.
I don't like it either. As a person who has to make videos,
well, you know, I got kids, you know, and I mean, they're grown up now. But you know, it's, you're going to go to a bar with your daughter and order a Sex on the Beach,
right?
You know, and I don't understand why they have to come up with that. But you know, that it always says something about the people that come up with it. You know, and it's they're people that aren't real connected to, you know, to moral fiber and standards and things. I have never myself sold products that were geared towards, you know, that were so sickly and sweet and that, you know, they would be geared to youthful drinkers. You know, I think the alcohol business is a serious business and you should be an adult. You need to know, you know, what the consequences are of drinking alcohol. I think there's enough business out there without having to tap into underage drinkers. And a lot of that stuff does just that. What 18-year-old or college kid isn't going to like sex on the beach?
It's probably going to be...
Or Dirty Stew or something. I mean, all the names that are indicative of that, to me, the cocktail's got to be garbage.
And some of them, I mean, there are a lot that are, I would say, new style. But some of them, like Sex on the Beach especially, seem to go back a few years. Like, they've established themselves.
They go back. And, you know, they were around when the whole cocktail thing was really in its infancy. You know, there's nothing like that coming out now. From the mixologist, that would be degrading to a mixologist because it would say nothing about his cocktail.
Right.
You know, to have something like the Castro Cooler, you know, people are going to say, well, what the heck is that? You know, Sex on the Beach, you're going to order without asking what it is. It's just they feel like ordering it. You know, you're young, you're impetuous.
You're
going to order it.
Yeah.
It's cool, you know. You haven't had kids yet, you know, you haven't had a serious girlfriend or something, or, you know, and then you can order something like that. But, you know, people today, the real mixology, these are very serious people. They feel this is a craft. They are crafting fine cocktails, and they view themselves very much like, you know, while I say it's in its infancy, the cocktail revolution, guys like Dale DeGroff go back to the Rainbow Room and have been mixing great cocktails for, you know, 40 years.
Right.
Those were the real pioneers. People look up to those guys now because they are the masters.
And I have the same issue because a lot of the drink names, because people ask me to cover them, like, oh, can you make a such and such? And for me, it's very challenging because I have to put my stuff in iTunes and I have to publish it online, and I don't want to be found by searching for, you know, weird names. I want to be found for the right drink. So, you know, there's certain ones like the Redheaded Slut I can get away with in Sex on the Beach, but there are guidelines when you publish these things into, you know, Apple software that says you can't use specific names. So I've just been renaming them because I don't know what else to do, and there's a damage to that for me because if I rename them, people aren't going to see them or they're not going to recognize what it is. So it's a tricky thing to do, but I had the same kind of opinion where the name doesn't buy me anything. To me, it's like I just want more exposure, and that's what ends up happening is a lot of the drinks that get a lot of views on like YouTube or 5minute.com or wherever tend to be these drinks that have these names because there's a lot of people searching for them, apparently, or they want to know, what is Sex on the Beach? You know, what am I buying? And it's almost reverse. You shouldn't be asking the question. You should kind of have that from the drink itself, from the spirit. You should be able to gather what it might be from.
No, I agree. It's we've stayed so far away from anything like that, you know, we're certainly not experts in those categories, nor would we participate in events that would be drink competitions to come up with something. I like things like, you know, simple things, the Midori Melon Bowl. I mean, that was, you know, it was a nice name.
Yeah.
Covered the product, you know, you kind of had an idea, you know, where we're going with the drink.
Like that drink. It's pretty good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, my wife loves it. And, I think, you know, drinks should be, you know, guide you a little bit to where they are. Obviously things like the aviation don't. But, you know, like you can look it up just like Sex on the Beach, but at least people wonder, you know, they have a different reason for looking up how an aviation's made and looking up how Sex on the Beach is made.
Right.
You know?
So,
and then when they look it up, they got to wonder, why would anybody name this like that?
I do the same thing. That's why I'm like, what is that? What is that? At least if you use the country of origin, you might have some sort of clue. What is when you had gone back earlier, you said when people stock what they have in their house for different type of liquor or spirits, I've got this question a lot. What are the things that I should buy? I'm a home cocktail enthusiast. I'm just getting into it. Maybe they just got out of college and they've got a job, so they have a little income they want to spend now. Is there any technique to what they should buy to complete their home bar?
You know, it's a good question, and I've seen some articles on it. I think, assuming, you know, you've got a little bit of money now and you do like cocktails, you know, so you need to have classic ingredients. So you have to have a gin, a vodka, a decent bourbon, So, you know, you could make mint juleps or, you know, Brooklyn Rye. Well, Brooklyn Rye would be a rye whiskey, but you know, those kind of classic cocktails. But so you'd want that. Probably want a maraschino liqueur. You know, you'd want some of the classic products that allow you to make the classic drinks, you know, and which would, you know, obviously include a tequila you like and things like that. So, you know, about 10, 12 products that make the classic bar. And one of them, you know, certainly in any drink that calls for a cherry, obviously we're biased. We sell the Luxardo Maraschino cherries, but they're real. They're fresh cherries.
Right.
And they're not, you know, they're not, you know, bleached and dyed and fluorescent colored.
Right.
And cherries and olives are, you know, two important ingredients in a lot of cocktails. A lot of the rest of it becomes, you know, depending on what style you like, you know, going out and buying the fresh ingredients to finish off the cocktails, you know, be that mint or limes, lemons, oranges.
Bitter? Like for bitters, are there any specific ones?
Absolutely got to have Angostura, you know, right. You got to have Angostura, you know, in your bar. And now Angostura has an orange bitter, you know, which is real nice if, you know, if you're making an old fashioned.
I'm still looking for that.
You know, and while old fashioned may sound funny, you know, when I find that when young people taste a well-made old-fashioned, they love it.
Yep. Same with whiskey sour.
Yeah, whiskey sour. I mean, heck, whiskey sour's been around forever. But, you know, now you make it with fresh squeezed, you know, juice instead of a mix, you know, the way they used to make it in the bar. When I drank whiskey sours when I went clubbing, you know, back in the 70s. And, you know, today it's different.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites. So, what are your feelings on, say, like egg whites inside of drinks? That's another one that I've had a couple people say you need to use egg whites. And there's the camp that says it's bad for you and whatnot.
Yeah, no, I love it. You know, pisco sours and variations of the pisco sour with egg white are absolutely delicious. You know, because the egg white froths so well and keeps the air bubbles in the drink. And that's tremendous. You know, a good pisco sour, a good caipirinha. These are all very delicious, refreshing cocktails.
So there would be no physical. I mean, from what I understand, is that if there's any, what do they put in egg whites? I can't remember. Whatever the problem is, that you're not supposed to eat raw eggs. They get killed off by
the salmonella.
Yeah,
salmonella or something. You know, it's pretty rarely a problem, really. I mean, it can be, but it's pretty rarely a problem. The big thing is. You know, you need to wash the egg before you crack it.
Right. Yeah, that's true. That kind of helps. And then I've heard rumor that the alcohol within it's going to kind of kill it off anyway.
You know, I've never been sick from it. I've had pisco sours. You know, it's not something I drink all the time, but I've had pisco sours over the course of the last 30 plus years, and I've never gotten sick from one. So that's not to say you couldn't. But I haven't. I don't know if the alcohol would kill salmonella. I certainly don't know that. You know, it isn't something I've come across that people get sick from it, but people eat sushi too, and there's parasites in sushi.
Yes, it's true.
You know, some people are, you know, normal, healthy people are resistant to a lot of these things.
Otherwise, you just have a bad day and you get over it.
You can, you know, but, you know, so those are, you know, that's a risk factor, but, I've had a lot of, at the Tales of the Cocktail, Dale DeGroff did, one seminar and, made a variation of a pisco, sour. And it was incredible. He used an herbal liqueur we import from France called Vervain de Verlet. It's sort of like a chartreuse, and there was a twist on the classic pisco, and it had egg whites in it, and it was delicious.
Now, does that the egg whites contribute to texture as well?
Oh, absolutely. That's exactly what I was saying. You know, the egg whites whip up, and they add a lot of air, you know, air bubbles, and that is a very alluring texture in the cocktail.
Okay, so very, that is good.
You know, it's silky. It's a very alluring texture in the cocktail. For example, I was in Arizona a year or two ago, and we were at one of Michael Mina's restaurants, and I came in, and there was a couple sitting there, and I go, what are they drinking? And you know, they're having a pisco sour. And yeah, I haven't had one in a while. And so the group I was with, we drank one. They ended up, everybody started ordering pisco sour. As we were having dinner, the bar manager came over and asked our distributor, sales lady that was with us. He said, you know, can you send me another 6 bottles of pisco tomorrow? He says, we blew through everything we had. You know, so they went through, I don't know what they had, maybe 2-3 bottles of piscos, but they went through just a ton of pisco. People just loved the drink. And probably almost no one there had ever had one before.
Right.
It's people really like that egg white adds a texture to the drink. That is really, you know, very nice.
I get the same thing from like a creme de coconut or even cream at some level adds something you don't get in a typical cocktail, and I think it changes. I mean, because you get your presentation, you get a special color you're going for, and then you get your garnishes. But when you get the taste, besides the flavors, there's, I do it with whiskey. The texture means a lot to me, you know. And
no, I agree. You know, and then, you know, milk or cream in drinks is also, you know, it softens up the drink, you know, and especially if it's in the evening, something that's very soothing.
Right.
You know, so those, I think those are really valuable ingredients, certainly not to be overlooked.
And the last question I had, are there, and you've probably learned, or as you've said, from just kind of being there and absorbing that, are there any places that people should go? Like me or whoever or somebody listening wants to say, I want to really focus on becoming a mixologist. I want to be known as somebody that knows how to make a good cocktail. Do they have to go to like a school for certifications? Do they go out and they just start working at a bar? Or like, what is the, how do you get to that level?
It's a good question. I know Dale DeGroff is starting a course for bartenders that will be a sort of a certification. There isn't any certification really needed. But Dale DeGroff, you know, he sees the need for people becoming, you know, more than just a bartender and knowing the chemistry and the balance and the knowledge base that's needed. So he started up a school with certification program, you know, sort of like the wine people have with the Master of Wine type of thing, you know. So that there's a qualification as, hey, this guy knows his liquors, he knows what to do with them type of thing. And it is actually becoming very necessary. I've got a guy in San Diego that came to us. He said, Henry, I want to carry all the stuff you have. He said, but can you help me find, you know, somebody that's going to mix these cocktails up at the bar, you know, with these products? He says, the guys I find, you know, they always are trying to sell my customers another Cosmo. Yeah, they don't know how to make all those drinks, and they don't want to bother with them. So it takes a combination of passion and knowledge. And, you know, so those people are going to be attracted. There are schools around the country that teach bartending and things. And but you really want to step beyond that. You want something from a guy like Dale DeGroff, who's really a master mixologist. The guy's got, you know, 4 decades of being one of the greatest cocktail makers in America.
Yeah, that seems like you should have one of these in all the major cities, because I don't, as a person, regardless if you want to be a mixologist as a profession or if you're doing it more as a hobby, I don't care that I can mix 2 colors as really fast and make, 50 Cosmos in 30 seconds. I want to be able to say, okay, I want to be knowledgeable about most of the major liquor styles. I want to know what a maraschino liquor is. I want to know what Bailey's does, you know, and how they might interact or not in a specific drink, which ones are going to blend well, you know, and be able to, after you get to that point, be able to walk away, look at some creme de coco, look at some banana liqueur and maybe some vanilla ice cream and go, I think I can make my own tasty drink out of that.
Yep.
I think we need to get there.
Yeah, you really do. You know, and then, you know, interviews like this and things, you know, all kind of keep pushing the envelope a little bit.
Awesome. I appreciate all the time you spent to kind of get us, not even just mixology, but we got a lot more information about the industry as a whole, which is pretty exciting, so that when we go to the store, we can look at the vodkas or whatever and go, oh, I understand now why maybe they do specific things they do or make larger bottles all of a sudden, and I think it's very informative.
Well, good. Glad. I'm glad I was able to provide some of that insight.
Excellent. Well, I appreciate your time this afternoon or morning for you.
You're welcome.